Welcome back to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today we're lucky to have Joe Fotinos. He's publisher of Dr. Napoleon Hill's famous book, Your Right to Be Rich. And we have him right here with us in the studio. When you think of riches, we often think of money and wealth. However, Dr. Napoleon Hill viewed riches to be more than just a number sitting in your bank account. Rather, Dr. Hill viewed true riches to be found in personal goals and dreams and in relationships. To be truly rich, Dr. Hill states, you must be rich in all aspects of life, both personally and spiritually. I couldn't agree more. Without further ado, Joel, welcome.
I'm so glad to be here.
What you do in terms of publishing Napoleon Hill, he's one of the cornerstones of the positive thinking movement, and his new book, Your Right to Be Rich, is kind of interesting, which we're going to talk about. But let me jump into this question. He uses the word transmute frequently. Explain to me and our audience, what does it mean to transmute?
That's a great question. Transmute really just means to change or to make different. And so when he's talking about transmutation, it's a very old-fashioned word. I mean, his book, Think and Grow Rich, came out in 1937. So it's very old-fashioned of the time. So, and when he talks about transmutation, he means literally to see something differently or to have a different experience of it. So, for instance, he talks a lot about transmutation of energy. And what he means is instead of taking energy and using it one way, you use it a different way and you'll have a completely different experience of it.
Okay. Now, again, when he speaks about energy, I'm sure that he's speaking about positive and negative energy. There are nine principles that he mentions, the alphabet of success, the nine basic motives. Okay, in the first principle, it was the definedness of purpose. Let's go through those principles. Tell me what they are.
Well, for the basic motives, he's talking about what really brings us to do anything that we do. Napoleon Hill was a great understander of human motivation and our foibles, what gets us out of bed every day. And so he really does talk about the different motivations we have. When he talks about that purpose that you just asked about, what he's saying is if there is something that you want, you have to find that thing that you want so much that it brings you to the point where you can get out of bed every day excited to do it. And that is the first principle of all the principles that he has. And he's written a number of books, and some of them have 13 steps, some have 9, 17, whatever. Every single one of them, it always begins with that one principle, definiteness of purpose. And he says that because he wants you to find the thing that just brings you joy and glee when you think about it.
I'm going to get back to that because it's so important in a second, but I'm hooked on the title, Your Right to Be Rich. Now, I noticed that it doesn't say you have a right to be rich. Is there, when we say basic human rights, obviously we're not talking about richness. You have to do something in order to get rich.
Yep.
And he's not just speaking about money, because when you ask a person about richness, they immediately go to dollars and cents.
Yeah.
I go to peace of mind and sense of purpose. So does he believe that everyone has a right to be rich, or everyone has a way that they could get rich?
I think Napoleon Hill would say that was the same thing. So there is a way that all people can find their way to riches. And you're right. He does not define riches just in terms of dollars and cents. He defines it as freedom for creative expression. And that's really the key that underlines all of Napoleon Hill's philosophy, is that it's not about chasing dollars. It's about expressing yourself creatively. And in that process, you become a bigger person. And as you become a bigger person, everything in your life grows, including finances. But also including relationships and including peace of mind and your sense of well-being. So when he says your right to be rich, what he means is there the principles that will work for one will work for all people. And it is your responsibility, really, to act on those. But when you do, you can absolutely, absolutely create the life that you want to have.
See, probably my initial instinct to that is, since everyone does not hear words the same, and culturally everything is interpreted based upon their culture, then the principles, with the wording of the principles, would have to be changed based upon what someone hears. Like, for instance, you said, as you get bigger, some people are going to think fatter. What does it mean to get big?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's probably no way to make everyone understand everything at all times.
Well, explain to me, what does it mean to be big?
What it means, what I mean by that is, what he means by that is to expand your life in a way, expand your mind, and expand your horizons. So many of us, he says, live inside of this box that is very undefined. And he talks about this and writes about it frequently, this undefined box. So if you say to somebody on the street, hey, what is it that you want in life? Many of them, in fact, he says 98 out of 100 people will not be able to tell you. And he says if you press them further and say, no, really, what is it that you want out of life? What do you really want? He said they will give you a very undefined answer, such as, oh, I'd like some more money. I'd like to be comfortable. I'd like a good job. And then he said, if you press them even further and say, okay, well, exactly how much money? What kind of job? He said, 98 out of 100 people will not be able to tell you.
I'm going to say that you're right in my experience. I mean, I'm doing executive life coaching and neuroplasticity, which is medical hypnosis, for now going on 35 plus years. And when we talk about people not being evolved, we talk about the first development of the brain is the mammal brain or the animal brain, and only later, 18 to 25, does the frontal lobe, the cognitive brain, you know, that doesn't have this negativity. You are extremely influenced by your environment. So what is Napoleon Hill? What is his suggestion when you grow up in an environment where people settle for very little and there's a tremendous amount of negativity and the person has low self-esteem and they don't know how to get out of their early child programming? What would he suggest for them?
He would suggest taking action. So here's an example. There's a great story where a woman raised her hand and said to Napoleon Hill, I need to figure out my way out of my childhood programming. That's not the language she used, but essentially she was basically saying, I didn't have any models for becoming successful. My parents were this, my parents were that. I grew up in this situation. Do you think, Napoleon Hill, that I should get some counseling? Should I get some training? Should I get some coaching? What should I do to get past that? And he said, basically, and I'm paraphrasing, he says, lady, you can do what you want. He said, but what I have found is the best way to get past that is to just take action every day. And for him, that was the way out of any conditioning you might have or any circumstances, is to be very definite about the thing that you want, and then every day you just take action toward it. It sounds so simple until you actually try to do it, and then it also sounds so simple until you look around and see how few people actually do that. But the people who do that are the people who tend to be happier and succeed in their life.
Now, I do agree with that. If you're stuck in the forest, if you just walk in any direction, you're bound to get somewhere.
Yep.
However, being Jewish and the fact that it took 40 years to, you know, for the Jews to walk for a 3-week trip, simply going somewhere doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get there. Wouldn't it?
But what's the alternative?
Well, my thought. The alternative is identify the blocks, identify where you want to head to, and have a plan from someone who knows how to do it. Because very, very often, if you tell someone to do something without telling them how it actually works, they'll say, yes, I understand, but they don't have actually the cognition or the ability to actually take a pragmatic step.
Right.
Okay. It's like work harder and the person's depressed. How do they work harder?
Yeah. Okay. Well, but when he says take action, he's talking about exactly what you're talking about. In the book, Your Right to Be Rich, he has 17 steps, which is the actual plan to get out of the forest.
And so let's go through some of those.
All right. Well, the first one, as we've talked about, is definitive purpose. Because if you're in the forest, the first thing you want to do is figure out, do I want to stay in the forest or do I want to get out? And he would say, you have to be very clear about what it is you want in life. Look at your life and don't just say, I want more money. Say, how much more money? At a certain point in my life, when I was filled with credit card debt, I had nearly $60,000 worth of personal credit card debt. You know, back then, if you had asked me, what do I want? I would have said, oh, I'd like to be a millionaire. But really, I had to come up with something specific. So my specific first goal was
get out of credit card debt. Yes, exactly.
Right. So that was a very definite number. And my number that I wanted to reach was zero.
Right.
That was the biggest number I can imagine. So he says, whatever it is you want in life, be that clear, that crystal clear. And then afterward, the second one he has is mastermind. And what he talks about this is that you don't always have to do this all by yourself, that there is a power that is greater when two or more people come together. So you get the benefits of someone else. It's almost like batteries. So when the group of people, whether it's two, three, four, five, six people come together and you say, this is what I want, now you have a benefit of a group of people who can give you the benefit of their information, their expertise, and maybe their help.
But, Joel, doesn't that work better if they know where they're going? Because, like, when I travel into different countries, I always hire a guide. Why? Because I know that they know the best restaurants. They know what the tourist traps are. They know what I don't know.
Right.
So rather than just me taking action, I would look for someone who actually knows how to get to where I want to go.
Right. Well, that would be part of it as well. I mean, you're not going to be in a mastermind with people who aren't clear as well. Remember, step number one is clarity.
Okay.
So you're going to be in a mastermind with people who are also clear.
So that's definitely part of the book, is find someone who's clear and someone who understands and shares your vision so they can mentor you.
And you can do the same as well. Because in a mastermind, you are really helping each other.
Okay.
We're only on two, and there's 17.
Okay.
So, I mean, he goes through with the contingencies that you're talking about. The third is applied faith. And he says, turn faith into action. What he means by that is not faith in some supreme being out there, but faith in terms of that the process will work if you work it. So, oftentimes what happens is when people start to move towards something, they get clear about something, they start to move towards something, and they might even have a mastermind group around them that's supporting them. But if they reach one of those roadblocks, if they reach a point of confusion, or maybe even thinking, is the thing that I've chosen as my clear goal the thing that I really want? He said, oftentimes people will stop right there. The minute it gets a little bit difficult, they will stop because they don't know what to do next. And he said, you have to apply faith, meaning you have to realize that the process he talks about in all of the steps will keep you going as long as you keep going. Another way of saying it is
endurance, persistence,
yep,
and tenacity.
Tenacity. Okay. And it's a choice. And he says very clearly that faith is a decision. And what it means is every day you make that decision, and that's how you are going to show that you believe that this will happen.
Right. Okay. So he's defining faith like scripturally. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, right? Yeah. So when someone has faith, they are going on the belief that there is really an end in sight, and they need to have the tenacity to get there.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that they should be around people who are going to support that.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And does he make a suggestion how people should find those people?
He does. Actually, he does. And that's part of that chapter of the book on the mastermind. He talks a lot about how to find those people. But, you know, what's interesting I have found is when you start tuning into that, when you kind of make that decision for yourself, that this is when I want to go to. Like for me, when I realized I'm going to get out of debt, I'm just going to do it.
So Joel, what's your number now? How much money do you want now?
Oh, I have reached so many different monetary goals using this method. It's fantastic. You know, okay. I'm talking 20 years ago when I had this. But the minute I made that decision, suddenly I was around people who seemed to have a similar goal as well. It's kind of that thing of if you want to buy a yellow car, suddenly you see yellow cars everywhere. You're just kind of raising yourself to that mindset, I guess, where you suddenly are noticing things that maybe you weren't before. And it's that way, too, when you make a decision and when you step out of that, suddenly you notice the people who are stepping out in that same kind of decision or their version of it in the same way.
So I normally apply the ability to make money as the ability to solve a problem. And the bigger the problem you solve, the more money you make. So if you're solving a problem of how to clean a floor, you're making minimum wage. If you solve a problem how to separate twins, you're going to make a lot more money. If you create a problem that anyone didn't even think existed, like Bill Gates, no one thought that information traveled too slow. He said, you know, this is really slowing down. Whether he thought of it himself or stole it doesn't really matter, but he came up with the ability to get that idea and obviously made billions. What does Napoleon Hill suggest in terms of how to find what your true passion is?
Well, he has a great story about that, actually. And the story is about a man who looked at the education system. And, you know, obviously when Napoleon Hill was around, this was 100 years ago.
When did he die?
He died in 1970.
1970.
Yeah.
It was a good year to die.
And Think and Grow Rich was published in 1937, and this book, Your Right to Be Rich, is transcriptions of lectures he did in 1954.
He must have sold millions of copies of Think and Grow Rich, right?
Tens of millions of copies.
Unbelievable.
It's still the number one personal finance book every single year. It's just huge still because it's so practical. But he has this story about a man who, back in the day, was looking at the educational system, and I believe it was in Chicago, and didn't like what he saw and had the idea. This was the problem that he identified, that there wasn't a school that was teaching the kids in the way that he thought they should be taught. And he had this idea, and something in him really wanted to change that. And so finally, he had this idea, which he said, I'm going to raise $1 million because that's what it's going to take to build this school. And he didn't know how to do it. So he waited and he waited and he waited. And finally, one day, he thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get that $1 million right away. So he put out an ad in the paper and he said, I'm going to teach a sermon at a local church this Sunday called What I Would Do with $1 Million. He shows up on Sunday. The place is packed because it was a very intriguing title, especially at that time. And for the sermon, he actually told the audience, this is what I'm going to do with $1 million, and I want $1 million right now. So at the end of the sermon, a man approaches him, and he said, that is a great vision for what you would like to do for $1 million, and I'd like to fund it, and gave him $1 million. And Napoleon Hill doesn't end the story there. He ends the story by saying that the man thought to himself, what was I waiting for so long? Why didn't I pursue this earlier? Now, what's interesting about that story in connection to the question that you asked is this was a problem that he identified, and a passion, therefore, grew out of that problem. And when he stepped forward finally, definitively, confidently, and came up with a creative solution, speaking at a sermon on a Sunday, the world around him supported him, I guess you would say. I guess he would say. The world around him supported him, and he ended up building that school. So the question is, how do you find your passion? Is you look around your life and you think, what do I feel strongly about? And if it's something I feel strongly about in a negative way, then maybe you are called to do something in a positive way to make a solution. Or maybe it's a creative endeavor that you thought there was no way I could make money from it. And you just move forward knowing that as you move toward the thing that you want, your life expands and everything in it expands as well. So does that answer your question?
It does. But, of course, having gone through so many people, the question is, let's say someone hearing that story, and it's a great story, says, you know what? I'm going to do the same thing. And not everyone shows up. And everyone thinks about what they would do with $1 million, and a check isn't written. So is the principle simply a principle that will always produce results, or is it a principle that just happened to be serendipitous to when he had then made that speech?
Well, I would say that it always has a result. So the man gave the sermon without knowing that there would be somebody in the audience that had a check. He took the step forward without knowing that there would be a result. Now, somebody may read that story and say, I'm going to do the exact same thing. So on Sunday, I'm going to give a talk, and 8 people show up, or 80 people show up, or 800 people show up, and they think, because that story in that book, it happened to him, it will happen to me. And that's not how Napoleon Hill meant it. He said, take a step, be creative, and be persistent. So if that person had not been in the audience for the man who wanted to build the school, that would not have deferred the man away from the dream. He would have kept going until he found it. That just is the way that he received the money that seeded his dream. But if that man had not been there, he would have just kept going anyway, and he would have found it. So I think the lesson of that story is, don't do just what he did expecting the exact same result. Feel inspired to do what you do in the way that you do it, and see what happens, and keep going until you get the result that you want.
So the idea is simply not to go, not to give up.
Not to give up, and to be open to creative ideas.
His explanation of re-educating one's brain. Okay. Tell me how he understands how to re-educate the brain, and which part of the brain, the early childhood experiences. I mean, how does he understand the brain itself?
Yeah. He doesn't understand it in terms of a psychological viewpoint.
Or neurological. Okay.
Yeah. He's not into the – when you read his books, he doesn't get into your childhood, traumatic experiences, all of that. What he's talking about is how to use your brain. So the way he describes it is using the brain through auto-suggestion. That's the word he uses. Again, it's kind of an old-fashioned word. But what he means is counteracting all of that negative self-talk that we have in positive ways. And what he says is that we have, and I believe the example he uses is that we have 5 times more negative self-talk than we do positive self-talk. And he said also that the negative self-talk is faster and more powerful than the positive self-talk. Part of that, we know, is through that fight or flight reptilian brain that we all have within us.
And the reason,
now we know it's part of your brain.
Well, the reason for that is that the first brain that's developed is the mammal brain, and animals generally are always anxiety-ridden, finding food or being killed and so on and so forth. So you know, in the first years of life, we are really absorbing everything that's surrounding us, as well as the society and the societal pressures. Very few people use the frontal lobe with the rational mind. Einstein said he only used 6% of it, and some people use none.
But this is his solution to that, or his action that you can take to begin using your frontal lobe.
Start to thinking positively.
Not just start thinking positively, but to overwhelm yourself with positiveness.
Okay. So that would mean what? Looking in the mirror and saying, you know what? You're going to be a success. It doesn't matter what my parents said. You know, they didn't know any better. I can be a success. I can make money.
Yeah.
Okay. What else would he suggest?
Well, his big suggestion for that is he has what he calls a contract that you fill out. And you fill out this contract and you put in a definite amount of money or a definite outcome that you want. Again, start with clarity. That's always his first thing. You start with clarity. And you then kind of put parameters around it, maybe a general time frame, so that you can stay moving and you don't just kind of sit back passively and say, okay, life is going to find a way to bring it. But you put a time frame on it so that you start moving and are active. And you put it all together in this contract that he talks about. And he says, every single morning, the very first thing you do in the morning, you take the contract and you read it. But you don't read it, just read it to yourself. You read it out loud. And he said, as you read it out loud, feel it, picture it, and make it yours. And then he said, at night, the last thing you do before you go to bed is you do the same thing. You read it out loud, and you picture it, you feel it, and you make it
yours. Now, someone's going to say, how do I picture it, or how do I make it mine? And he's going to say?
He's going to say, clarity, whatever it works for you. I mean, I know that there are some people who are not very visual.
So when you wanted to get out of that $60,000 debt,
yes,
what did you do?
I did just what he said. I wrote out my contract, and I said, I want to be debt-free. I would like it within a certain period of time, and I am willing to do what it takes.
What did you do next?
So I did that every morning, and I would read that out loud. And what it would do is it would take me out of the, oh, my God, I can't believe I have so much debt. I'm so stupid. I feel bad, et cetera. And it would put me into openness, and then I would sit there, and I always have a pad and a pen with me. And I would just sit there, and I would be in that space, and whatever came to me that day to do, I would do. So, for instance, oftentimes it would be, you're going to be in a situation where you will want to use your credit cards. Let's find a better solution. And I would think of it ahead of time so that when I was in that situation, I wasn't just in my autopilot. I was now in control because I had thought ahead of the situation, and I had a better creative solution. And so that doesn't sound like a big thing until you repeat it 360 out of 365 days a year, and it adds up into a tremendous difference in the way that I was doing things.
So what it did is, if I understand you, it brought you to a level of place of thoughtfulness.
Yes.
Where you were aware of your decisions, and you began to make better decisions because you thought of consequences.
Yes, and I started my day that way.
So did you build a business, by the way?
Not at that moment, I didn't. But what I did, one of the actions that I took so that I could get incredibly clear is I went to an accountant.
And robbed him.
Hey, that would have been a faster solution. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
But I went and I sat down with him, and he's the one that said, this is your exact total, and it was $57,000-some-odd. And I said, you know, in your expert opinion, how long will it take me to get out of debt? And he did all this calculations. You know, this was 20 years ago, so it was the calculators that had the white tape out, you know, and all this white tape started coming out. And he goes, great news. If you do not use your credit cards again, and if you get a small raise every year, it will only take you 23 years to get out of debt. And, you know, I wanted to – that was the worst moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But I began using these principles, and I actually got out of debt in 3.5 years.
So how'd you do it?
I just told you how I did it. Every single morning I started with my goal of mine.
You told me your state of mind,
yeah,
of how you did it.
Right.
But you didn't exactly – you either had to earn more money.
Ah.
Okay.
You mean that kind of –
Yes, the pragmatic part.
The pragmatic stuff. So I really did start every day with this place. And some days it was hard to do it because, you know, when you're – trying to shuffle around bills to be able to pay them.
And the reason, Joel, by that I'm impressing, the reason why people get very antsy with self-help books and as well as religion is that they become inspirational but unobtainable.
Right.
They don't know what steps to take to do it. So that's why I'm pressing, how did you actually physically create that money?
Yeah. First of all, I did all the steps. I had a mastermind. I did what he calls going the extra mile. You know, so if I was going to try to not debt this week, I would try to not debt even more this week. But on a very pragmatic level, since you're asking that, I changed everything. So I had to find ways to not use my credit card, which meant saying no to a lot of things, which was very depressing. I created a budget for myself. I began using what I now know is the snowball method to pay off my credit cards. I didn't know that then. I kind of created it for myself, and I thought it was the best thing ever. And I didn't realize until later that But that's actually a method out there, the snowball method.
And you know, I'm going to ask you, what is the snowball method? Get a hard snowball, hit the banker, hopefully he has a concussion and doesn't remember your own money. What's the snowball method?
The snowball method is I had 23 active credit cards, okay? And, you know, I mean, well, they kept sending them to me. So I thought they must know what's... You know, they must.
In the early days,
they must understand me.
In the early days, there were infomercials that literally, that the way to get rich is get 100 credit cards and keep on borrowing. You know, from one to another. That obviously didn't work.
No. Okay, it didn't. I was in my early 20s. Right. What did I know? And I didn't have a good model myself.
So tell me the snowball method.
So the snowball method is I created my own spreadsheet. I didn't have Excel. I used pencil and paper.
Right.
And I listed all my credit cards in order, not in order of the interest percentage, but in order of how much I owed total for each credit card. So some credit cards I might have owed, you know, $200, and some I owed thousands of dollars. And I put them in order from the lowest total amount owed to the highest total amount owed. And what I did is, what I used to do was I tried to pay all the minimum payments plus like $5 for each of them, which with 23 credit cards was over $100.
Right.
Instead, what I did is I paid the minimum payment for all of them except for the one that I had the smallest balance on. And I took that $115 that I was putting on all the others and I added it to my minimum payment just for that one. Well, suddenly that's a big chunk and I was able to pay that one off within a couple months. So I took that entire total, the minimum plus the 115,
and you rolled it
and
into
I
the
added
next
to the next one, and suddenly there's a lot there. And it becomes a snowball so that you never are diminishing the amount that you're paying every month, but you're using what you pay every month in a very targeted, specific way. And so people often say, well, shouldn't you target the credit cards that have the greatest amount of interest first? And my experience was no, it was to stop having so many minimum payments because that's what was killing me. And so I began doing that, and I was out of debt in 3.5 years. But other things that I did too, I mean, I decided...
So did you fire your accountant for not figuring that out?
I had paid him on my credit card, by the way.
I'm sure that was the last card you paid.
But the value of inspirational books... Because you're right, inspirational books aren't going to – they didn't tell me to do the snowball method. But what they did is they inspired me to come up with a creative solution.
Got it.
And I stayed inspired that whole time. And at a certain point, because of the philosophy like this, instead of feeling like a victim of my debt, I instead thought, wait a second. I'm responsible and I can get out of this. I'm not a victim. I've got solutions. I can find ways out. So I ended up – having a ball paying off my debt. I would do things like I used to take my friends out for dinner. That was one of my big things. And I'd pay, and then people would give me their cash, you know, for their portion.
Right.
And
then you would spend the cash and still have the debt.
Exactly. So what I did to change that, because I loved having dinner with all my friends, is we began having potlucks usually at my place or one of their places, and we would each bring something. We had more fun than when we would go to the restaurants.
So you found it a creative way of doing
creative
it.
Creative solutions. I suddenly found
that... Did you charge them each $50 and put that through your credit card?
Yeah, just to get in the door.
Right.
That was a cover. I found all these free things. You know, at that point I had moved to New York City and I saw that there were the free movies on Wednesday nights in the summer in Bryant Park.
Right.
Well, that was free. And yet it was so much fun. And so... There were free days at the museum. And so instead of having to pay for everything, I found that there was actually a lot out there that was in my budget, which was practically zero. And when I got out of debt 3.5 years later, and I actually had a big party, and I paid cash for it, by the way, I almost missed it in a way because I was so focused on my goal that it became such a joy and a pleasure. But then I quickly... got new goals, and that was great fun as well. But that's what he means. That's why there's value in these books, is they keep you inspired so that you realize that you are not in that little box, that little generic box. You are out of the box, and you can do whatever you want, and you can find ways to get whatever it is that you want. I did, and it didn't take me 23 years to do it.
Right. Now the truth is that you had a good mind, and it sounds like you really weren't suffering from anything traumatic. You just needed to be creative.
Well, I had depression.
You had some depression.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean,
did the depression go after you paid off your debt?
It certainly got better, for sure. It didn't hurt it.
You know, if you don't have to pay for that medicine, it's really good.
Right. I mean, you know, anybody who has debt who's listening, they know how dark it can feel and constricting. And,
sure.
You know, my salary was much less than what my debt was. And so it was dark.
Right.
You know, so this was the way, getting inspired and having somebody like Napoleon Hill say, you know what, apply your faith, use these tools, use auto-suggestion, use your imagination. That's one of his big things.
One of the things that is conditional, and this is kind of interesting, is you need to believe yourself. And in order to believe yourself, you can't lie all the time to yourself or to others.
Right.
So I would think that there's a condition of basic integrity and honesty to yourself and to others that allow you to make statements of faith, because then you have credibility. If you're lying to everyone, including yourself, then even telling yourself a new idea won't work.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, I mean, that's when your actions and your desires match up. Because if not, you can go around saying all the time, I want $1 million. But if you are not in accordance with that, if your actions and your self-talk are not in accordance with that, then you're not going to get it. And that's another form of lying to yourself. You're saying, I want this, but I'll just sit on my couch and eat Cheetos and not do anything about it. So, you know, really, part of what the inspiration is for is to help us stay in integrity with what it is that we want.
Good. So staying in integrity does mean self. You have to be aware of yourself, and see where you're out of sync,
right,
with your values and with your behavior.
Right.
Now, I guess the mentors' role is to help you create those values. Does he go into how to find a mentor?
No.
Or basically he's trying to teach how to become your own mentor by training your brain.
I think he would say that if you train your brain and you do the steps that he outlines, and in Your Right to Be Rich, there are 17 steps, you will, maybe one of the steps is that you will seek out a mentor. He doesn't say that specifically, just like he didn't say for me specifically to use a snowball effect, but I was inspired through that creative solution. And I think that's what he would say is, he talks a lot about imagination. And the reason he talks about imagination is because he wants you to get out of what you know, because we don't know what we don't know. But our imagination is one way that we can get out of the ceiling of what we know into what can be. And when you get into that place, that's the place where I am. I'll speak for myself. I am inspired by ideas that I never thought possible, or ideas that will help me get what I want. So that would be the place where I might think, you know what? I absolutely need a mentor in this area. I need a coach in this area.
That's a great point, Joel. Absolutely great. Once you get the idea, find out who knows how to do it, yep, and work with that person.
Yep.
I love it. What were some?
And he says, when you have that idea, take action immediately. That is a big point of his, is when you get the idea, take action, because that idea has energy. And if you act on it right then, it's going to have energy and create some more momentum. If you just wait, and I'm not talking risky behavior.
I completely
understand.
I'm talking
positive actions.
Most of the executives I treat, their one most spoke about problem is procrastination.
Yes.
You know, and for most people who are not moving along, is if you wait, then the momentum changes and your faith changes.
Yes.
So that makes sense.
Procrastination is, you know, it's a great way to stay stuck. And he, at the beginning of Your Right to Be Rich, Napoleon Hill says, read this book, and as you read it, do three things. He said the first thing that you should do when you read this book is you should take notes. So as you read it, ideas are going to come. Write them down. And the second thing he says, now that you've written these ideas down, add more ideas. Let this be a springboard into thinking of other ideas. Really, make this your own. And then the third thing he says to do is do this every day. Why wouldn't you do this every day? Why wouldn't you reach that kind of creative place where you now are having ideas and all of that? And he said repetition is the word he uses. Use repetition. Do it every day. And when we do that, we're going to be less prone to be in that place of, well, I don't see how it's going to happen to me. I don't see when it's going to happen to me. Because when we are in that place, of course we can't see how it's going to happen necessarily. I can't see how anything's going to happen. But I can begin moving toward the thing and allow something to happen that's going to open me up.
Does he advocate to rid yourself of negative people, negative thoughts?
Yes.
He does?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Which I would completely agree with. What are some of his other great suggestions?
Well,
and what do you think the key of his success was? I mean, Think and Grow Rich sounds like, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of success books, but this guy's been since 1936 still selling these books in the hundreds of thousands.
Right?
Why? What was his What's different about him than any other author?
Well, he was not a get-rich-quick kind of guy.
Okay.
So he got the charge to study people from Andrew Carnegie, and who said, I would like to see if there is a commonality between all these wealthy people in America. Are there common ideas or common actions that they took that made them go from rags to riches? And Napoleon Hill said, I'll do it. He was a journalist at the time, and he said, I'll do it. He spent 20 years, and he interviewed the 500 wealthiest people in America. And Andrew Carnegie opened the doors, of course, because right. He was the wealthiest. And what he found out 20 years of study was that there were commonalities, common ideas, common beliefs, and common actions between these wealthiest people in America. And that's where the philosophy came from. And then he spent the rest of his life talking about those commonalities. The first commonality was definiteness of purpose. They got clear. And that's where he begins with everything. So, you know, all of these things that he's writing about are not things that he just thought up out of the blue. A lot of people will write self-help books because they need that self-help themselves.
Right. It's most psychiatrists, psychologists, that's why they have the highest rate of suicide. They go into the field to try to help themselves.
To help themselves. Yeah. And also, I mean, I've read so many of those personal finance books, and in the introduction of many of them, if not most of them, they say they got their start by reading Think and Grow Rich or another book by Napoleon Hill. And the reason Napoleon Hill has stuck around all these years and has inspired all these people to become millionaires and billionaires or to follow their dream or become Academy Award-winning actors is because the principles he talks about are so universal, but they go right to our human condition. Like I said earlier, Napoleon Hill really understood our foibles. He understood the things that stop us: procrastination, fear of poverty, fear of death, fear of ill health. He talks about the fears that we have that stop us. Indecision stops us. So one of his big ideas is decision, making sure that you are deciding and not being in that in-between place. So he really understood human nature, and these were the things that take us out of those actions that keep us small and keep us stuck and move us into a larger experience of life.
I think that was brilliant of him. What were some of the other commonalities about those extremely wealthy people?
Well, one of them is...
Because you know the old adage, it takes money to make money. Obviously, that's not true.
Right.
Okay, so what are some of the other commonalities?
Well, here's one that actually sounds very quaint, but it's very powerful. It's have a pleasing personality. This is actually number 5 in the 17 steps in Your Right to Be Rich. Have a pleasing personality.
I guess Trump didn't read that book.
He talks in there about, you know, the spirit of cooperation rather than competing with each other. You know, you get so much further when you cooperate with people than when you try to compete with them. You can stay in your own lane with your actions, but helping each other, he says, and actually having a pleasing personality not only takes you further with them, but it actually makes you feel good, and the better you feel, you actually are going to go further.
You know, I agree. One of the reasons why babies are, God made babies cute and dogs lovable, is that's how they survive. You know, that's how they survive, is by smiling and being cute and being fragile. And dogs also, that's how they have survived, is they've learned to be nice.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And other people have survived by not necessarily being nice, but they do get people to follow them, because when you have the absence of belief, your tendency is to gravitate towards people who have a belief.
Right.
You know, which is why it's so important to find out what your belief is. Otherwise, you'll fall into a cult or extremism, and that's really not so good.
Yeah.
I'd love to know what else did he find common in those billionaires or millionaires at the time?
Here's another one, which is learning from adversity and defeat. That's number 12 on his list. And he talked about in this book that so many people will suffer a defeat and they will just stop right there and it will shut them down. And it will stop them either for months, years, or maybe their life. And we certainly all know people who fit that bill, that maybe they had a certain kind of defeat and that just kind of stopped their forward movement or growth at that point. But he says, and one of the quotes he's famous for is that within every defeat lies a seed of opportunity. And but the way that you see the seed of opportunity is you have to learn from what it is that caused the defeat or failure in the first place.
Actually, that's what the frontal lobe does. I mean, one of the wealthiest men at the time was also Edison. And in one of his famous statements is, I know 1,001 ways not to make a light bulb.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so he saw every defeat as an opportunity to learn to make sure the next time he gets closer to success.
Exactly.
So, and you're right, because people are, they're, you know, they could go to a restaurant, they love it, they get one bad meal, they stop.
Right.
You know, or they have an idea and they give up on it.
They give up.
You can't give up on that which you truly believe.
Right. Well, one of my mentors is a woman who owned a business in Denver, Colorado, and she had her first business. She opened it up, spent a lot of money, obviously, a lot of time, and the business failed very quickly. And she could have just, you know, said, well, that's it, and I guess I'm not meant for this business, and just ended it right there. But instead what she did is she started asking people, why do you think that my business didn't work? And she listened to what they had to say, and they had very practical things to say. They said it was a beautiful place, a beautiful store, but it was hard to get to, and there wasn't a parking lot right there. And, you know, it was just a little too far away. And she thought to herself, wow, that's really great feedback. And she opened up another store, but instead of a large store, she opened up a small store, which was 900 square feet, but it was in a great location. It had parking, and it was easy to get to for people. And it took off like crazy, and now she owns several stores. It's a chain of stores in Denver, and it's wild. It's been successful ever since. Every time she reached a roadblock, she would ask questions. Why is this a roadblock? What am I not knowing? And in just asking that question, she was doing what Napoleon Hill talks about, which is she's trying to find the opportunity in what seems like a defeat. But instead, it's just like, oh, this is going to make me actually more successful once I figure this out.
One of the things that I love about the book is that it does stress the idea of integrity, endurance,
yep,
clarity, and mentorship. And that's why, in my mind, he has lasted as long as he does, and while he will continue to last, because he's making way for the evolution of the economies, which have changed. You know, lots of the stores that existed don't. Most of the stocks on the S&P are now no longer in existence. Well, the Dow, everything has changed. But his principles are still relevant.
Well, they're relevant, and oftentimes people will say, you know, well, the times are different, so, you know, well, these principles probably won't work. But what he pointed out is that he published this book, right, his first book, not his first book, but his famous book, Think and Grow Rich, in 1937, right at the tail end of the Depression. And he says in that book, even though the mass thought at the time was that the depression was that everybody got poor. He said there were people who got very rich during the depression.
Of course.
Right. And he said, if that can happen during a depression, how do you become one of those people? How do you use creativity? How do you step out of that mass thought, which is, I can't do it, and everybody agrees with me that I can't do it because no one can do it, and you move into a different place, which is, gee, how can I do it?
I'm curious. Did he have a political bent? Was he, you know, was he a political man?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know.
Okay.
He certainly not in any of his writings.
Interesting.
He admired people like Andrew Carnegie. He admired Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Edison, Emerson, Thoreau. Those were the people who were his heroes, and he writes a lot about those men in his book.
Right, but he goes from intellectual to industrialist, so it's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
Real pleasure having you. The book, which everyone actually should pick up, Your Right to Be Rich. I think there's more depth in that book than one can imagine. So the idea of having a guideline and taking it to wherever it leads you, finding a mentor, learning how to use your brain, because that's my big thing, that most people don't know how to use their rational brain. They just go right back to their emotional brain. But he is timeless, and you are a great spokesman for him.
Oh, good. Thank
you. So thank you for coming to the show.
I appreciate it. I thank you for having us.
It was my pleasure. I want to once again really thank Joel for coming on to our show. He was such a pleasure. I just want to take the time to remind all our listeners, as stated in Your Right to Be Rich, when someone says something can't be done, it's simply because they haven't found the way to do it. You press forward with your ideas. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and on YouTube by searching for Errol Gluck. And visit my website, glucksolutions.org or .com, glucksolutions.com, to learn more about how executive life coaching and clinical hypnosis can change your life forever. If you change the way you think, you change the way you live. Thanks for listening. Till next time.